Oh, Lhasa. So as we begin for the final time, our little mini-cycle on the Shamatha Without a Sign, I thought I'd share with you a complete teaching, and it's very short, on this practice, but you'll see a subtle variation, and I think some of you who are practicing either settling the mind or awareness of awareness, I think you might find it very helpful to see how he actually merges the two practices. So what I've been offering you over the last 7 weeks, if this has been effective, then when you hear utterly classic teachings, bearing in mind this is from the 17th century by one of the really foremost contemplatives and scholars within the Gelupa tradition, I mean, so august, so extraordinary, that he was chosen to be the tutor of the fifth Dalai Lama. You have to be very special, I think, to be chosen to be the tutor of the Dalai Lama, like the creme de la creme. And so he was. This is one of the Panchen Lamas, Panchen Losan Chukyi Gyantsen, 17th century. And so if what we've been doing here for the last 7 weeks, if this is really part of a continuum, a lineage, and not something that I've concocted or I've specially manufactured for a modern audience, if this has been authentic, then as you're listening to it, then there will be a certain familiarity. You'll feel, ah, yeah, but this is familiar. Oh, yes, that was familiar. Ah, that was a bit new. That's interesting. And so that you'll feel somewhat at home, but now you'll know that in a way we're going into a time machine because the translation is very close. And we're just slipping right back as if we are becoming disciples in Tibet in the 17th century. That's a very different time and place, right? And so that's what I'll be sharing with you. And very, very briefly, I received the oral transmission, the explanation on this, 1975, a long time ago, from one of my principal teachers, Yeshe Rabten, marvelous Gelupa Lama. And it's been in my heart and mind ever since, quite extraordinary teaching. And so this was his teaching on Pinchen Rinpoche's teachings on Mahamudra, and within that context, his teachings on Shamatha as an immediate preparation for, of course, the Vipassana and really fathoming the nature of the mind. So, here is his teaching. Of the two approaches of seeking to meditate on the basis of the view and seeking the view on the basis of meditation, the following accords with the latter approach. So here, this, because I've studied a little bit, this is immediately familiar. There are two approaches here. One is by first getting good education. I spoke about that yesterday in reference to a discussion that Guido and I had about really going for teachings on the Dzogchen view, and really learning about it, reflecting upon it, gaining some clarity, maybe getting some really kind of some insight conceptually, and then into the nature of emptiness, into the nature of rikpa, and then bringing that into your meditation. So in other words, your meditation is really launched by your study and reflection, your study and contemplation, right? So there's one approach, authentic approach. And then there's another approach, and that is where you're just taken and just put right into the pool. That is, you're taken, first of all, right into the meditation, right? With maybe not much in the way of theory or view at all. Just, here's the method. Jump in, like jump into the water. We're not going to give you a lecture on the nature of water and H2O and so forth and so on. Just, here's the water, jump in. And then out of the meditation comes the view. In other words, radically empirical. So could this be the case for understanding the nature of the mind, a view of the nature of consciousness, nature of mind? The answer is yes. Could this in principle, this practice of shamatha, focused on the nature of awareness itself, could this actually lead you to the Dzogchen view without having teachings, without having pointing out instructions and so forth, or empowerment, Dzogchen empowerment? Could you do something like this practice and have that lead you directly to an experience, some genuine taste of rikpa, pristine awareness, and from your own immediate experience, be viewing reality from the perspective of rikpa and thereby embrace the view? In other words, could you get the Dzogchen view from your meditation rather than having to have the Dzogchen view first and then that leading to your meditation? And the answer is both work. Both work. And we have this from Padmasambhava. So I'll tell you, if I express an opinion here, I'll let you know when it's coming. So far, there's no opinions. This is just right from the tradition. Very powerful lineage. Padmasambhava, natural liberation. He says there are two approaches. Those who first are introduced to the view, and then they go into the meditation. Those who are first introduced to meditation, and out of the meditation comes the view. Between these two, my tradition is the latter. In other words, just the opposite of dogmatism. It's just radical empiricism. And then lo and behold, the view comes out of your own experience. And I would say a lot of you have a taste of this already from these last seven weeks, let alone how much you had before that. But from your own experience, this has come up time and again in our one-on-one meetings, where through your own experience, you're saying, ah, I had a sudden insight, and this has shifted my perspective on something, right? You're getting a view from your meditation, not because I taught it or you learned it from a book or from some other teacher, but from your own experience. It's quite powerful. It's quite powerful. Okay, so as Padmasambhava said this 1,200 years ago, my approach is be introduced to the meditation, let the view come out of the meditation. Lo and behold, here's this consummate scholar. I mean, vast erudition. Penshen Losan Shugi Gyanzen. Oh, big. And he's saying, this one, meditation first, let the view come out of that. Okay, that was a long commentary to his first line. The rest of the commentary won't be that long. So now you're getting classic teachings, as if you were a Tibetan living in the 17th century, and moreover, a direct disciple of Pinchen Rinpoche. You must have very good fortune, right? On a comfortable cushion. Oh, I love that word, comfortable. What makes a... Miles, it's a pop quiz for you. You're on. Miles, what makes a cushion comfortable? Wow, that's a good answer. This guy's been around for a while. What makes a cushion comfortable? The extent to which you can be comfortable while you're sitting on it. Yes. Yes. And then what enables you to be comfortable while sitting on a cushion? Quiz number two. You did so well on the first one. Yeah, relaxed and visual posture. In other words, settling your body in its natural state. But having that sense of ease in your body. And in other words, you're bringing the comfort to the cushion. The cushion isn't bringing comfort to you. Now, of course, there could be some comfort, like with broken glass on it. It would be hard to settle your body in the natural state. So I would choose, you know, not that kind of cushion. Those with barbed wire linings and so forth, there's a certain kind you wouldn't want. But yes, what makes a comfortable, you know, given the normal formalities, that's maybe a little bit soft, that's it. So when he's saying this, he's really talking about what you're bringing to the cushion. And that is when you're there, it should be comfortable for you. So if you're sitting upright and you have a scoliosis and you're not comfortable, you're not sitting on a comfortable cushion. Then you better go supine. But if you can be sitting and you're comfortable, then carry on. So he says, on a comfortable cushion, for the cultivation of meditative stabilization, or dhyana, assume the sevenfold posture. So now he's going classic. Sevenfold posture of Varochana. I won't give all the 7 points, but this is more or less it. Assume the 7-point posture, the sevenfold posture, and with the 9-fold breathing, clear out the stale vital energies. This would take too long. I'm not going to give that. You can learn it in so many sources. It's a way of alternate breathing, cleaning out stale air and energy. Then carry on. Carefully distinguish. Now listen closely and see how much of this is familiar and how much might be a little bit new. Could maybe further enlighten or give a sharper edge to your own practice. Carefully distinguish between the radiant purity of awareness and its defilements. And with a pristinely virtuous mind, begin by taking refuge and cultivating bodhicitta. Taking refuge now indicates you're entering the path revealed by the Buddha. Cultivating bodhicitta indicates you're entering the path of the Mahayana leading to full Buddhahood. Meditate on the profound path of Guru Yoga. That could easily imply not only are you entering a Buddhist path, that is following the path of the Buddha, not only that, but the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva path, but in addition to that, you're following Vajrayana path, because this profound path of Guru Yoga strongly associated with Vajrayana. And after making hundreds of heartfelt supplications, asking for blessings, like in the fourth phase of great loving kindness, great compassion, and so forth, calling for the blessings. Let the guru dissolve into yourself. So coming to the crown of your head, facing the same direction as yourself, the guru's body, speech, and mind dissolving indivisibly with your own. So it's now as if you imagine your own guru's mind, the Buddha's mind, indivisible, of the same fluid, like pouring one glass of water into another glass of water. Now you can't tell the difference anymore. It's not just one glass of water mixed. And it's with that mind that you venture into the practice. Do not, and now we go into the main body of the practice. Do not modify the evanescent or fleeting, ever changing. Do not modify the nature of evanescence, appearances with thoughts such as hopes and fears. So the appearances come and go. They're always coming and go. But don't modify them. Don't contaminate them with hopes and fears. But rest for a while in unwavering meditative equipoise. This is not a state in which your attention is blanked out, as if you'd fainted or fallen asleep. Rather, post the sentry of undistracted mindfulness and focus introspection on the movements of awareness. Anila, I haven't called on you ever, I don't think. Why does awareness move? He says, your awareness may move. Introspection on the movements of awareness. What makes awareness move? Why would it move?
Lost in thought.
Couldn't quite hear.
Lost in thought.
Lost in, why do you, thoughts happen, but why do you get lost in thoughts?
Because the knower isn't.
Because?
The knower isn't strong enough. The awareness isn't strong enough.
Yeah. It's not strong enough to do what?
To catch the thought.
To catch the thoughts.
Or to not run after the thoughts.
Or to not?
Run after the thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. I was looking for a word. You gave the meaning without the one word that I was looking for, which means you still got the meaning. And that is what makes awareness move. If you had to put it, let's see if I can kind of just try to tease it out. If you had to find one word that said, this is why awareness moves, what would be your word? Why does it get jerked off to the referent of the thought and jerked here to the future and the past and so forth? What's the one verb, the one word, the one verb that makes it?
Verb's not my strong point.
What's that? Can't hear.
Verbs are not my strong point.
I can't hear. I can't hear you. Okay, Anila's jumping out of the boat. Quinn is yours. Go ahead. Just give me a word. I'm going to give it to you soon.
Grasping.
Grasping is the word I was looking for. Grasping. Yeah, grasping nails it. It's because of grasping. No grasping, your awareness rests in its natural stillness. Grasping, your awareness moves. Past, future, whatever. Okay? Thank you, Meek. Thank you, Anila. And so, there it is. Focus introspection on the movements of awareness. Focus closely on its nature, that is, the nature of awareness itself. Focus closely on its nature of cognizance and luminosity, observing it nakedly. Sound familiar? Cognizance and luminosity. What are those two? How do we characterize those two? Mia. Cognizance and luminosity, what do they have to do with awareness or consciousness?
More.
Right, like an ice cream cone.
Nature of consciousness.
I can't hear.
Nature of consciousness.
Still can't hear.
Nature. More.
Still can't hear.
More. Nature.
Nature of consciousness. Definition of more. Consciousness. Yes, exactly right. That those are the defining qualities. That which makes consciousness conscious, cognizance and luminosity. Focus closely on its nature of cognizance and luminosity, observing it nakedly. Nakedly means without. Well, without clothing. That's what naked is. Without the clothing of conceptual fabrications, elaborations, cogitation, rumination. Be quiet and just observe it nakedly. Whatever thoughts arise. Now, interesting, look at this. He's saying, closely observe the very sheer cognizance and luminosity of your own awareness, observing it nakedly. But now, what about all those pesky thoughts that keep on coming up? Whatever thoughts arise, recognize each one. So that's a possibility, right? You're observing it, thoughts come up, just note them. And preferably, you don't have to release because you didn't grasp onto them in the first place. You're simply aware of thought arising, thought passing. But your focus is on the awareness itself. There's one possibility. Alternatively, he's going to give another possibility. Like a participant in a duel, Any duals come to mind? Completely cut off any thoughts that arise. Okay. When there is stillness, after they are banished, relax loosely, but without losing mindfulness. Sound familiar? Relax loosely, but without losing mindfulness, without losing clarity. Okay. As it is said, focus closely and loosely relax. It is there that the mind is settled. Is it nice, the time machine? You enjoying the time machine? Slipping back 400 years? Relax without wandering. As the saying goes, when the mind is tangled up in busyness, when the mind that is tangled up in busyness loosens up, it undoubtedly frees itself. So all this emphasis by this old California hippie, relax, lighten up, loosen up. I didn't just make it up. This is one of the foremost yogis and contemplatives of all of Tibetan history. He's saying this 400 years ago. Two Tibetans. So we see this is not just some special advice for Westerners who are all screwed up and tense and wired and multitasking and ADHD. This is for Tibetan nomads 400 years ago, right? And farmers and so forth. So he continues, whenever thoughts arise, if their nature is observed, they naturally disappear and a clear vacuity arises. Likewise, if the mind is examined when it is still, a vivid, unobscured, luminous vacuity is perceived. And this is known as the fusion of stillness and motion. Which of the four types of mindfulness from Dujum Lingpa is that? 1, 2, 3, 4. Fusion of stillness and motion. Regina. You breathed. I heard you breathe. Which of the four types of mindfulness? First, second, third, or fourth? If you don't know, you don't know. It's no big deal. Not sure. Ian, come to your mama's rescue. Rescue your mama. That's your job.
Space of the mind.
Which of the four types of mindfulness?
Oh, sorry.
Sharp Vajra Tantra. Four types of mindfulness. I've repeated it maybe two or three times now. Yeah. What's the 1, 2, 3, 4? Which corresponds to the fusion of stillness and motion? The experience of the simultaneous. What? No. I'm looking for one of four types of mindfulness. That's a whole shamatha practice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cecil, there's only one more. You're the last hope for the family. We have an island in the Indian Ocean to which we banish people. When the whole family can't get it, then it's one-way ticket.
Can we have a drum roll, please? It's the first type of mindfulness of the observing the simultaneity of mindfulness. Of motion and stillness of awareness.
That's right. And you got it right. And do you remember the name of it? What's the name of that first type of mindfulness? You remember the name of it?
Single-pointed awareness or mindfulness?
Single-pointed mindfulness. The family is redeemed. Okay. There's your champion. Okay, jolly good. That's it. That is exactly right. But you see here, Dujum Lingpa coming from a mind treasure in the 19th century. Here's an enormous scholar, incredibly erudite scholar, 17th century, same Dharma. It's acultural. Whatever thoughts arise, we continue, whatever thoughts arise, do not block them. Pause. So now you'll be, well, which is this? Is settling the mind or is this shamatha without a sign? But there he says it. Whatever thoughts arise, do not block them, but recognizing their movements, focus on their nature. Anna remembers that. Focus, it's merely, and that's not a question, but you can relax. But you remember that. Just observe their nature. Don't get into the commentary, the labeling, the constructs, the categorization. Just, boom, got it. Right? That's what he's saying here. Whatever thoughts arise, do not block them, but recognizing their movements, focus on their nature And now look at this metaphor. Like a caged bird on a ship. Anybody remember a caged bird on a ship? Ring a bell at all? Sustain your awareness as in the saying, like a raven that flies from a ship, circles around, and alights aboard once again. So he's suggesting in this one, he's just calling this shamatha, shamatha on the nature of the mind. He's suggesting on the one hand, you can respond to the thoughts by just giving them the hatchet, the guillotine. They come up, boom, like the duel, flicking away the arrow. That's a possibility. But within the same practice, he's saying, alternatively, you can let those thoughts be like the raven. Circles around, and then just alights in its own time. But as they say, since the raven has nowhere else to go, it just comes back to alight from whence it arose, from the nature of the mind. And so you observe it then dissolve back into the mind, and there you are. Then you're just allowing, letting them be. But you are observing them, and you're not being carried away by them. The nature of meditative equipoise is not obscured by anything. When you're resting there in that balance, your mind resting in its natural state, but it is limpid, that is transparent and luminous, and clear. Not establishes anything physical, that is this mind, this consciousness, has no physical attributes. Not establishes anything physical, it is a clear vacuity, like space. Allowing anything to arise, it is vividly awake. So it's empty like space, and yet it's luminously clear and awake. Such is the nature of the mind. This is superbly witnessed with direct perception. So there it is. You remember how often that's come up in lucid dreaming, with direct perception. You know the nature. You know the dream as the dream. It's not something you're analyzing, inferring, thinking about, figuring out. Boom, you just know it. Like you know the taste of chocolate, you know this is a dream. Boom, you've got it. And likewise here, the quality of knowing here is not caught up in a network of thinking, cogitation, memory, analysis, and so forth. It's boom, just straight. That's direct perception. And so we're really calling on this more primal, more basic, more fundamental way of knowing that is the knowing of the substrate consciousness. Right? So seeking to know from that platform. Not from an Argentinian platform, or Brazilian, or American, or German, not from that platform. That has its validity. Not dismissing it. That has its value. The cognitive platform, the conceptual platform. That's ordinary mind, coarse mind. But here we're seeking to cultivate a sustained flow of knowing that is working in a more basic level, that is pre-verbal and pre-conceptual, but clear, distinct, radiant, luminous, sharp, discerning, but more intuitive, more direct, hence called direct perception. This is superbly witnessed. So he's, hey, this is something really special. This is superbly witnessed, this nature of the mind, with direct perception, yet it cannot be grasped as this, such that you can start talking about it or conceiving of it. You can't capture it with a concept. You can't capture it with a conceptual mind. So it's rather... humiliating is the wrong word. Something similar to that, though. Because really intelligent people, people are good at analyzing, thinking, figuring out, really, how do you say, sharp business people, scientists, mathematicians, people working in big programs, developments, then we can pride ourselves. People who know how to think really clearly, analytically, really sharp and smart, they do well on IQ tests. Such people, it's very easy to identify that with that which we do well. You know, and that's how you know. So I'm a professor. Now I will teach my students, this is how you really know things. And then I teach them how to analyze, remember, and so forth and so on. But what he's saying here is that you may have an IQ of 160 and have 3 PhDs. But however smart you are, however superbly tuned your conceptual mind is, you won't be able to wrap it around this. You can't do it. Doesn't matter how clever you are. Your thought will not be able to grasp this one. It will always slip through your fingers. No matter how smart you are, no matter what endowed chair you have at one university, you'll think, I'm a professor at Oxford. I'm a professor at Cambridge, at Harvard, at Yale. I can understand anything. Yeah, not this one, buddy. This one will slip right through your fingers. And then if they continue, then they say, it's not knowable. I can't know it, therefore it cannot be known. That's one way of doing it, right? Or you can just recognize that there are different ways of knowing. And now we have two. You know, the conceptual one, that the conceptual coarse mind is very, very accustomed to. Some people are very good at it, some people not that good. So it's a lot of variation there, like so many other things, talent in music and so on. But he said, no, this is more primitive. But here's the beauty of it. Although intelligence, IQ, varies a lot. Creativity, some people very creative, some no, not so much. Talent, music, mathematics, science, art, and so forth. Some talented, some not. But now, among you, who has the better substrate consciousness? Yeah, that's the right answer. Wait a minute, this is prior to all that stuff. Now, might some people have propensities, karmic imprints, and so forth in past lives that are in some way superior? I mean, a greater storehouse of virtue, greater momentum, like tukus. So what is stored, coming back to, I think it was a conversation with Maria, I believe so, of, you know, what this substrate consciousness, what is it? Is it a storehouse full of all kinds of information, or is it a luminous, silent, blissful space? And the answer is yes, both. But when you're just resting in it, then you're not picking up all the information stored there. You're just resting in its simplicity, as it, when it's just quiet, it's resting, it's still in its own natural state. But if you arouse it, and this is the beauty of it, bear in mind, resting in the substrate consciousness is not being gagged. You don't have masking tape over your mouth so you can't think. It's just that you don't need to think. You're resting there, silent. But as soon as you want to engage, put your 12-cylinder Maserati into gear, and you want to direct your attention to the past, or start meditating on emptiness, or developing bodhicitta, you're ready to go. And so it's exactly there. If you get an interest of, well, now that I'm resting in this luminous space, the Hubble telescope, my awareness, has gone beyond the stratosphere of my coarse mind, and I'm in this open, luminous space, rather like, you know, like on the Hubble telescope. Wow, it's a lot of space, and it's so clear. The stars, I've never seen them so bright. The moon, the planets, never seen them so bright. It seems like there's almost nothing between us. So bright. And that is, you're looking into the space of the mind. You're saying, gosh, if I wanted to direct my attention to something, like an experience I had 2 weeks ago, what's between me and it? What's between me and the target? My awareness right now and the recollection of that target? The answer is, not much. Not much. Because there's no noise. There's no distraction, there's no blah, 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 there's no rumination, there's no dullness. It's clear space. And so you direct that laser pointer of your attention back 2 weeks, back a month, whatever you like. The first day, do any of you remember the first evening that we had here? It was 7 weeks ago. Do you remember anything about it at all? Was I sitting here or sitting over in the corner and so forth? Did I talk or was I totally silent the whole time? Try hard. And certainly something comes up. Something comes up, but it's coming up with a lot of other stuff in between, like more recent memories, the clutter of the mind, and so forth and so on. But imagine there's just no clutter. That you've gone now, you've gone into the submarine of your mind, auga, auga, and you're going down, down, down. And so you're like 100 meters down below, and now you try to find your target 7 weeks ago. Easier, a lot more data. There's not so much junk in between, hardly anything in between. So the possibility of having very vivid and very detailed and accurate memories. Very good. Very good. So, but this just resting there, the knowing of the mind, cannot be grasped as this. And that is, if you haven't, and this is what he's really getting at it, if you've not been there, when you come out, you may find words that are very meaningful for you. That is, you might use words like luminosity and acuity and so forth, and you know exactly what they mean. Now, let's just imagine you've just come out. Listen, Matt Lesham, Cecil has just been bathing in the cool waters of his substrate consciousness. And he just knows it. But he just knows it. I mean, he just knows it like a person eating a chocolate bar, whether you know the taste of chocolate or not. Like, I totally get it, right? And then he comes out of meditation. And he talks to somebody who's never meditated before. And the person says, Cecil, how was your meditation? What happened? What did you know? And Cecil comes out. Sure, I can talk about it. I was in a space that was resting in a mode of awareness that was without any borders. It was luminous. It was vacuous. It was clear. It was knowing. The person listening goes, hardly have a clue what you're talking about. Luminous, you mean like light? Was it yellow or was it brown? What color was the luminosity? Like, they won't really, even though this is perfectly good English, there's no way that Cecil can instill in this person the experience of what he just had. And it doesn't matter if he talks for 1 minute or talks for 5 hours straight. There are no words so clever, so articulate, so well chosen that he can transfer experience to somebody else. Cannot be grasped as this. But you can experience it. Once you've experienced, then yes. And then if you have, so if Alma has also had that experience, she's been drenching in her own substrate consciousness, then she comes out and she talks with Cecil. The two of you can have a long conversation and you could be totally mind-meld. You could just start anticipating each other's words, and as soon as you say luminous, she says, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And you don't even need to talk about whether it's bright and all that kind of business. That wouldn't even come up, because you've been both drinking from the same well. So now you can have a whole conversation back and forth, but if you're surrounded by people who have not had the experience, they will think they know what you're saying, and they will be wrong. But you will communicate perfectly, right? That happens a lot. Happens a lot. So you didn't grasp it conceptually, but now that you've had the taste, you can find the words, and if the other person has had that experience, you can communicate very well. Oh yeah, we're almost finished. So, yet it cannot be grasped as this or demonstrated with words. And now a quote. Whatever arises, rest loosely without grasping. That's one of the aphorisms among the yogis of Tibet. Whatever arises, rest loosely without grasping. Have you ever heard anything like that before? Has that come up? Can't quite remember. Okay. Nowadays, for the most part, contemplatives of Tibet uniformly proclaim this as practical advice for achieving enlightenment. Whether it's just do this practice and shazam, you know, Buddha nature, dharmakaya, rikpa, emptiness, and they'll give big, grand, exalted enlightenment itself, awakening. Hallelujah, I was doing this practice and I am awake. Praise the Lord. He says, a lot of people say that. However, I, Chukyi Gyantsen, he's the Panchen Lama, however, I, Chukyi Gyantsen, declare this to be an exceptionally skillful method for novices to achieve mental stability and to identify the relative nature of the mind. So the exaggeration, the inflation of methods and terminology, oh, you've done this, oh, good, you realize nirvana, oh, good, you realize Buddha nature, rikpa, you've achieved this stage of mahamudra, and so forth and so on. This is not just something that kooky Westerners are doing nowadays, or not even kooky, just inadequately informed, and then leaping to conclusions that they would really like to conclude. It's been going on 400 years ago in Tibet, you know, but not by this man, because this man is this fusion of extraordinary erudition, great scholar, formidable meditator, brings the two together. So that's his words. So this is a method to identify the relative nature of the mind. Oh, yeah, who am I going to pick on? Chitra. What's the relative nature of the mind? Clear and luminous.
Non-conceptual.
Clear and luminous are. Can you give it a noun? What's the relative nature of the mind? How about a noun? I guess that's a noun. I think it's a gerund. You're speaking with a former professor here. Look out. I'm fishing. Is it clear and cognizant? Yes, that is. Those are the defining characteristics of consciousness. But the relative, the essential nature, but the relative nature of the mind. It's another word I'm fishing for. It's extremely familiar. When you've realized this, then you can say, I now know the relative nature of the mind, the essential nature, but at a relative level. In other words, not emptiness, not rikpa. That's not relative. But relatively, I now know the essential nature of the mind. And when do you know that?
When you're in the space of the mind.
When you? Ice cream cone.
Oh. When watching the space of the mind.
Yeah, you're watching, but you may still be befuddled, confused, not still getting it. When can you say, nailed it, got it? I now know the relative nature of the mind, the essential nature. Now I know it, and I've got it. Jagan.
Stillness? Stillness?
Stillness? Stillness happens in deep sleep. Not enough. Good, but no banana. I couldn't hear. Just say it louder.
It creates illusions.
Alma, you can relax. It creates illusion, yeah. But that's an answer for a question I didn't ask. So it's the right answer, just not for my question. Gudo, your name is so auspicious. When do you know?
It's non-conceptual.
Non-conceptual, that happens when you have a severe frontal blow to your forehead.
When you're resting in the substrate consciousness.
I'm glad you said substrate consciousness, because substrate would be you don't know anything at all.
Substrate consciousness,
that's it, yeah. When you've rested in the substrate consciousness, you are immediately experiencing, to be sure, the luminous and cognizant nature of awareness. But when you're resting there, now you see it naked, unadorned by your culture, your background, your language, your gender, your concepts, and all the configurations, the many, many configurations of the mind that are conditioned by so many causes, neurophysiological, cultural, past life, who knows what. But now you've just shaved it down, you've peeled it away, so there's just the raw nucleus. Not an ultimate level, not the emptiness, not the rikpa, and that's why I said relative. While some people are proclaiming this, they experience, and it's easy to understand. I think we should be quite gentle here, and not as if, oh, we're so smart, they're so stupid, we're better. But you can imagine, if you've been meditating, and you've maybe one of these really hardcore yogis, you've been off in a cave for 6 months, a year, or whatever, and you finally come to a state of meditative equipoise where the world has vanished, and you're abiding in a continuous flow of bliss, and your awareness is bright and is non-conceptual, why wouldn't you think this is the clear light nature of mind? This is rikpa. Hey, it's clear, it's light, it's rikpa. Give me a break. Why isn't it clear light rikpa? I mean, what more do you need? Come on, you know? All the adjectives fit. And is it rikpa as an awareness? Yeah, I'm aware, I'm totally aware. Clear? Yep, check. Luminous? Check. Blissful? Check. Nirvana, you betcha. Enlightenment, Dharmakaya, Mahamudra, Dzogchen. The adjective, this is once again, the adjectives are the same. The same adjectives you find when discussing the substrate consciousness. This is the same words. Luminous, still, etc., etc. But once again, if you have, let's say, Alma, now let's elevate Alma, we're going to promote Alma right now. Alma's realized rikpa. Right, Alma's realized rikpa, imagine. And she's talking with Cecil, who's only realized substrate consciousness. They start talking back and forth. And then after they've spoken only for a minute or two, then Alma says, oh, I see our words are similar, but no, you have not realized what I've realized. It will come out. Even without her being clairvoyant, being able to dip into your mind, take a little scoop. But just by listening to the words and how they are used, you say, aha, you have an authentic experience. But now, by the way you talk, I see it's not rikpa. But now if she talks with another person's realized rikpa, for as long as they talk, there will be no point where, collapse. Clear all the way through. Okay? Yeah. So that's it. So you've just had an excursion 400 years back to classic teachings by a great lama, and for a little while you're his disciples. So, Now you just got me. Tough luck. So let's practice. Imagine doing that practice. Having entered a dark room and staying there for 49 days and just doing this practice. That would give you a real up close and personal encounter with the nature of your own mind without distraction. So maybe when we have contemplative observatories, a nice necklace of them around the globe, each one should have at least one or two cottages that are designed. You have to design them specially, that can be dark, where you need ventilation, so it needs a bit of intelligence there. But Tibetans did it with hardly any technology at all. Nowadays, it'd be a cinch. But you could be totally in pitch black and still get food, be able to go to the toilet, do the basic things, good ventilation, so always fresh air. 49 days, you and your mind, no interruptions. Quite interesting. Okie dokie, let's see what we have here. You talked about the seductive, how seductive, the bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality can be when shamatha is achieved, and the importance of authentic motivation for moving on. Yep. I think and hope that I'm authentically motivated in the practice of shamatha, but I'm never sure. How can I know? Is there a way of ensuring, checking authentic motivation? Yeah. Continue doing it. Continue doing it. And that is, if on Tuesday you check your motivation and you give yourself an A+, as far as you can tell, it's just impeccable. You don't see any contamination by mundane concerns and so forth. Then does that guarantee that your motivation on Wednesday will be just as good? No. You can be distracted. You can fall back. So it's an ongoing process of self-honesty, increasing vigilance, introspection, monitoring how the thoughts arise, monitoring the type of desires that arise. We had 24 years ago, when we had the one-year retreat, there was one fellow, charming and so honest, who was there for the whole 1 year. All of them stayed for the whole year. And he did very well. He had a very meaningful experience for that year in shamatha. And he said towards the end, because I would, not always, but I would often translate for Gyalam Rinpo when they'd have their interviews with him, he said as he was doing really well, he wound up doing 4 sessions a day of 3 hours apiece. Okay? Good, solid practice. But he said as he was really getting into the flow of it, he clearly, you know, got very much into the flow, then he'd be sitting there cruising along, and he said the thought would come up. Now, bear in mind, this is 24 years ago. He said, the thought would rise, maybe I'll be the first Westerner to achieve shamatha. And if so, maybe I'll appear on the Johnny Carson show. So it's a cute thought. And so utterly charmingly, you know, candid, that thought arise. Now, did he glom onto it and say, now I will strive all the more diligently because I want to be on the Johnny Carson show. I want him to say, and yes, Mr. Dunn, how does it feel like, Mr. Joe Doe, how does it feel like to be the first one to achieve shamatha? Let us know. Well, he just saw this kind of quirky little funny thought arising. It arose. It vanished back into the thought of his mind. So there it is. But if he glommed onto it, of course, that could be a problem. Oh, yeah. So karma is transmitted in space and time by the non-physical quanta or continuum of consciousness, the substrate consciousness, you should say, and the physical prana. So the non-physical quanta or continuum of consciousness, correct, and the physical prana, or gravitational wave, again, now we're using metaphors, of course, but that's fine, or electromagnetic wave of matter, of energy or matter. It's not matter, it's just energy, yeah. So where is Rigpa in this process? Rigpa's out of the picture. Rigpa's out of the picture. It's untouched by the three times. It's in the fourth time. Rigpa is, I'm looking for a big enough adjective, absolutely unconditioned. There's nothing you can do. That is, you could be the worst demonic serial killer, evil, sinister person in history, that doesn't even taint the slightest bit Rigpa. How much karma you have, how much you purify your mind, you develop authentic bodhicitta, direct realization, that doesn't improve your Rigpa. No matter what you do, it doesn't tarnish your Rigpa. Rick was out of the picture, out of time, out of time. Yeah. So where is Rikpa? Out of the picture. Is it Dhammadhatu? Out of the picture. Dhammadhatu is beyond time, indivisible from Rikpa. This absolute space of phenomena, indivisible from space-time energy, that is, space-time energy, absolute space of phenomena, the fourth time, and the energy of primordial consciousness. Okay? Yeah, totally different. So this is where the dimensions are different. And there are some things. So I mentioned, for example, I won't go back there, that some things are relatively ineffable. Relatively ineffable. If I've tasted chocolate and Michael has never tasted chocolate, unlikely, a German, they've got chocolate, really good chocolate. But, you know, so imagine I've tasted chocolate, he hasn't. Then, no matter how much I talk about chocolate, I'm just not going to be, it will be ineffable to him. My words will never capture it from him. They won't convey it. He won't know what I'm talking about. And so, relatively speaking, because I've tasted chocolate, he hasn't, then the taste of chocolate is ineffable for him. But for me and for Cecil, he's eaten a lot of chocolate. We can talk about chocolate and the merits of Belgian and German and Swiss and the problematic of English chocolate. Sorry. Poke. And Mongolian chocolate. Interesting. In any case, and Russian chocolate. There's an interesting Russian chocolate. Nicola's not here. Russian chocolate's quite a trip. Yeah. In any case, that's relatively ineffable. But when you come to Rikpa, Rikpa, by its very nature, defies all conceptual categories, including existence and non-existence. You cannot say accurately that Rikpa exists. You've just put it into a conceptual category. Does not compute. You cannot say it exists. Okay, non-existent. Not that one either. Wherever you go, it just doesn't fit. So you can say Rikpa all you like, Rikpa, Rikpa, Rikpa. You can talk about it, but none of the words capture it. So we see when it comes to Rikpa, when it comes to Dhammadhatu, but Rikpa especially, when it comes to Rikpa, of course, there are whole large books written by tremendous contemplatives and scholars about the nature of Rikpa. But none of them are even attempting, if they really know, you know, if they're good scholars, if they're good Dzogchen scholars, let alone contemplatives, they know before they ever put pen on paper or whatever, the chisels or the woodblock, that it doesn't matter whether they write one sentence or whether they write a 1,000-page tome, the words will never capture what they're talking about. So then why write so many words? Because there are many, many books on Rikpa. All of them are instrumental. It's a different use of language. By metaphor, lots and lots of metaphor, lots and lots of images, pictures coming to mind. And all of these, the words, the imagery, and all of that, the poetry, all of this designed to whip your finger out. It's an instrumental use of language. Not descriptive, as if I talk long enough, you'll get it, but instrumental, if I talk sufficiently and skillfully, I will direct your awareness there to taste it yourself. So very different. So that by nature, unlike chocolate, which is ineffable if one person's had it and the other one hasn't, Rikpa, even if two people have realized it, they will both know that their words completely fail to capture it. But they may both know that the other one knows. Okay? It's by nature ineffable and inconceivable, unlike chocolate and relative truths in general. Then in Shantideva's second question, that was by Regina, the second one by Regina, in Shantideva's book, Bodhisattvatara, in the 10th chapter, this is the dedication chapter, he wishes all beings in the hell realm to be free of suffering and to find the happiness of Sukhavati. Sukhavati, the pure land of Amitabha, please explain what are the hell realms. A really bad dream that lasts a long time. They weren't there waiting for you. When you really, I mean, at first glance, if you're just trying to get people to be more ethical and you can teach them literally, and that's fine. But the hell realms were not there waiting for you. And then, you know, somebody with tweezers picks you up, the Lord of Death or whatever, and tough luck, buddy. Not like that, okay? The hell realm you're born into arises when you're born there because it's created by your own mind. It's like a really, really, really bad non-lucid dream. And it lasts for as long as your power, the power of your own karma, sustains it. That's it. So it has no existence apart from your own mind. Does this mean that it's not real? Well, tell that to a person who's having a non-lucid dream. This is as real as it gets. If you're not lucid, you're not lucid, and this is all there is. So when you're there, long time. Long time. And they always speak of, whenever they speak of hell realms, they always speak of them being lasting a really long time. Do they really last literally that long? Well, imagine that somebody forces you, torture, forces you to put, you know, an electric, stove, the coils that all light up and turn red, you know, so an electric stove, like a coil, everybody knows, yes? Imagine somebody forced you to put your hand on it. They force your hand down on that red hot burning coil. 1 second would feel like a long time. 5 seconds would be a very long time, let alone anything longer than that, right? You can imagine this would tremendously arouse the vividness of your attention. Can you imagine? That's massive stimulation. So objectively speaking, you have been throttled into extremely intense vividness of attention. You're picking up milliseconds of pain here. And the more milliseconds per second you have, the longer it will seem. So it's always described as long. But then there's a lovely story in this regard. And it's, take it literally, take it mythologically, metaphorically, any way you like. From the, I can't remember, but I know it's from the sutras. It's a story of the Buddha in a previous lifetime. I think this was when he first developed bodhicitta or great compassion, some noble quality of the heart, when it first really, really lit up. And it said in the story that this being, he wasn't a Buddha, he wasn't even a bodhisattva yet, I don't think. No, he wasn't a bodhisattva. Just a being, he was like you or me. He was in a hell realm. And it's a particular hell realm. And if you think of this, you know, don't try to think of some place, I mean, how many kilometers below the surface of the earth and all that kind of business. Just think of this as a really intense, non-lucid dream. And then everything makes perfectly good sense. So in this dream, in this hell realm that he was born into, he was a beast of burden, like a big ox, something like that. It doesn't really matter, but a big beast of burden. And he was yoked with another beast of burden. Let's call him oxen. So he was one ox, and he's yoked with another ox. And they're pulling a very, very heavy wagon of, you know, whatever, piled high with stuff. And they're going up a steep hill. And these two beasts of burden, so let's call him Gautama. That's what he'd be named later. Gautama is one of these two beasts of burden. And it's a steep hill. The weight is intensely heavy. And then the wagoneer has a whip. And he's just, you know, just slashing the skin of these two poor beasts of burden that are trying, they're struggling as hard as they can to pull this massive weight up the mountain. And the wagoneer is just vicious. He's just beating them, and they're trying, and beating them more, and they're trying so hard. And so finally, the oxen right next to Gautama is so fatigued, so just so wiped out, and so in pain, just collapses, just falls down on its knees, just it's had it, it's broken. And then the wagoneer in the story, he beats it harder. Get up. Beats it. At which point Gautama, as this beast of burden, turns to the wagoneer and says, I don't know, strong emotion arising. He says, my companion can't take it anymore. Beat me instead. In that moment, the wagoneer took his whip, lashed him, whipped him, and killed him. And by killing him, released him from the hell realm, and he took fabled rebirth. The moral of the story is, you can't be in a hell realm and compassionate at the same time. That whip was his liberation. And that hell realm wasn't left behind. As soon as he left, it was gone. His hell realm vanished. Just like when you wake up from a nightmare. There's nobody left in the nightmare waiting and wondering whether you'll come back. Right? Purely creation of your own mind. So hell realms are as real as a nightmare. And when you're in the midst of the nightmare, that's as real as it gets. Are they in relationship to a receptive cognitive reference in the mind? Are they in the bardo? No, if you're in the bardo, you're in transition, you're on way someplace else, future existence is karma, and so forth. So that's it. That's what I have heard. So that's not a New Age interpretation. And in Dujum Lingba, he looks at so many things from this very, from the Dzogchen perspective. And it's really kind of a deconstruction. If you know that term philosophically and in terms of literature and so forth, a deconstruction. Dujom Lingba goes and he addresses the hell realm. He said, so if we're gonna, if you can take the, he's writing in the mid-19th century to primarily nomads. He was living way out in the boonies, like Wyoming or out in the bush in Australia. You know, I mean, it was really, this was raw country. This was not a sophisticated area. But doesn't mean when they weren't intelligent, and some of them are very highly educated in Buddhism. But this is actually in his mind treasure coming from Padmasambhava, and then he writes it down. But he says, you know, if you grasp onto those hell realms as truly existent, they're really there from their own side, they're absolutely real, then tell me, all these denizens of hell who are beating and torturing and so forth, are they getting a lot of negative karma here? And by the way, who are their parents? And who made, and Shantideva asked the same question, and if you're talking about molten lava and beings being tortured in molten lava, who created the burning grounds, the molten lava? Who created this? Who are the parents of the beings there? Are they getting negative karma by torturing people? When do they ever get out? And so forth. And you just start asking these questions, and the whole thing just falls apart. It doesn't make any sense to grasp onto it as truly existent. Nevertheless, when you're there, you're there. So, quite helpful. Oh, yeah. So how about one juicy question or observation? And we'll go to Jane. Yes, please, Jane.
Alan, could you talk about how a practice that actually helps us transmute those transgressions that we've committed? And they often arise out of meditation. In other words, those things that we need to address, mm-hmm. we need to transmute, and we need to acknowledge,
right.
and if necessary, apologize for.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I know that you're not alone in posing that question. There are people here, and also just recently I've received emails from a couple of students of mine, I guess, who are in long-term retreat. Same thing coming up. They're dredging the psyche. A lot of stuff comes up. And I don't know anybody. There probably are some people. I just don't know who they are. For whom, no matter how deeply they dredge, just nothing regrettable comes up. There may be such people. I just haven't ever met one. And I'm certainly not one myself. So it's a very important question. And that'll be a nice one to end on. Especially, for example, when you're settling the mind in its natural state. You're facing right into the gale, right into the wind of memories and all that kind of stuff coming up, every sentence that comes up. Then memories are dredged. You're not dredging them, but they get dredged by themselves. And some of the things being dredged, one then sees clearly, especially from today's vantage point, that was really harmful, that was unwholesome, non-virtuous. And so when you're right there in the midst of that practice, settling the mind is natural state, whatever comes up, you just let it be homogeneously. Just let it be. You don't feel remorse about it. You don't arouse some good Dharma response to it. The Dharma response is what it always was for all of them, just like Penchen Rinpoche just described. Whatever it is, just let it be and observe its nature. That's it, full story, nothing more. At the same time, as you very rightly point out, some of these things really call for remorse. So, for example, if I walk out and my mind wanders, and Quinn is standing right there to my right, and I wander out, and there he is in his bare feet, and I'm just spaced out, and I step right on his foot, you know, I'll feel it immediately. What's just the natural response of any decent person with any sense of courtesy at all? You immediately say, I'm sorry, I was totally spaced out. I'm sorry, I hope I didn't hurt you. Well, that's just natural, right? But to just step on the foot and say, well, you're in my way, that's not Dharma. Whatever it is, that's just not Dharma. That's anti-Dharma. So feeling remorse, I'm sorry I stepped on your foot. I will be more cautious. I'll be sorry. I'll be much more mindful. Can I help you? Did it hurt you anyway? If so, I want to help. Go to the front desk. That's just normal. That's just basic fundamental decency. But that remorse is authentic and it's appropriate. And it feels bad because, I'm sorry. I didn't. I'm sorry I hurt you. I had no intention. Let alone if I get really, I don't know, get upset. I get upset and just some mental affliction comes in. And I say something really, and then now, you know, leave Quinn. I already stepped on his foot. I won't beat him up anymore. But somebody else, I say something really unkind. You know, something thoughtless, something a little bit maybe jagged, a bit sarcastic, a bit, you know, putting down, like that. And when I said it, you know, I'm in my little refractory period. It seemed so clever at the time. You know? Like, I threw the dart, hit the bullseye. And then I come out of my refractory period. I said, oh, that was not a helpful thing to say. That was hurtful. And coming from a bad place, your mind was being condescending, arrogant, angry, whatever it is, whatever it is. So even though it was intentional, it's coming right out of a mental affliction, of course. So then afterwards, so let's say meek. I've just said something really, you know, 10 minutes ago, something really kind of dismissive of meek, like that. Let's imagine. And then, and then 10 minutes later, I'm out of my refractory period. And I said that not only to meek, didn't deserve it, but I also said it in public. It might have been a bit humiliating. Then it's worthwhile. It's appropriate. Feel remorse. Seek meek out. Apologize, and especially better, apologize in public. Because not only did I say something unkind to him, but I said it in a public domain, which means it was shared. This means good. Let's tit for tat. Let the response be appropriate to, corresponding to. Apologize publicly now. Said something really dismissive, a bit condescending. Not appropriate, not helpful, let alone from a person who's here to teach Dharma. All the worse. And so, proper remorse. And the remorse for what went by, but then it doesn't have much value if that's not immediately coupled with a strong and sincere motivation, a resolve. I won't do that again. Meek, you have my word. I will not do that again. I'm really sorry. I may come to a refractory period again, but this is my firm resolve. This is my promise. I can't say I'll never come to a refractory period. I don't have that power. But if I am, I will recognize that, and it will not come out my mouth. That's my resolve. That's my promise. I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I won't do it again, but this is the big deal. This is my promise. I won't do it again. And that's where it really gets purified. Feeling remorse for what we've gone by in the past, but coupled immediately with a strong resolve to avoid in the future. Then it really means something. Really means something. Whatever it may be, whether it's simply a little, you know, accidentally stepping on somebody's foot, no real harm done, okay, but I'll be much more mindful when I'm walking out. I won't stomp on people's feet in the future. I'll be very mindful of where my feet go, and so forth. So those two. Having said that, Shantideva in his other text, Shiksha Samachaya, comments rather early in the text. He deals a lot with remorse, applying the four remedial powers. He said remorse is very valuable. It's important. It's an authentic and purificatory response to regrettable deeds. He said, and now don't overdo it. Don't overdo it. So, for example, coming back to this rather small one, so I step on his foot, no real damage done, but then every time I walk in and out, I just glance over at Quinn and I feel guilty, like I can't look him in the eye. I'm one of those foot stompers. You know, I'm sure he will never like me again. You know, I'm a foot stomper. What can I say? I'm just one of those awful foot stompers. You know, I only did it once, but nevertheless, once is too many times. I'm a foot stomper. I'll never achieve shamatha or vipassana. I'm going to foot stomper hell, where I'll just be there lying on my back and people will step on me for thousands of years. Too much. He said, overdo it, and then take all the joy out of your practice. All the enthusiasm goes out, all the lightness, all that vanishes. Now, how do you ever expect to repay the kindness of sentient beings, to progress along the path to enlightenment, if you're just beating yourself up all the time? So find that almost like you're doing something with precision, enough response, appropriate, but not too much. Don't get bogged down. Don't get fixated. Don't go into the cognitive fusion, I am a foot stomper. I am a snotty, condescending person, because on one occasion I said something to meek. Okay? No, you're not a condescending, snotty, contemptuous person. You did it once. If you make that a pattern and you just do it regularly, okay, then that'll be a pretty good generalization. But don't go there. You made a mistake, you remove it, and then now don't do it again as much as you possibly can. So that's where the purification comes in. But I'll end on this note, which is a very, very important one. Buddha himself said that when it comes to karma, if we had, no matter, for all of our positive karma and negative karma, right? There it is. the upper form realms, lower realms. If we had to experience the effect of every intentional deed, virtuous and non-virtuous, that we ever committed, there'd be never enough time. If we consider how many intentional deeds have you committed in this lifetime that were either virtuous or non-virtuous, well, there's just no way. That's just in one lifetime. That would be thousands of lifetimes, all coming out of one. So you would have this massive debt, you know, that would fill galaxies of all your unspent karma waiting to be maturing. But in the meantime, you're accruing so much more karma that they have to wait forever, like, when is my turn? When is my turn? You know, there's no way. It would never happen. Not the virtuous, but especially the non-virtuous. It would never happen. So how does this work out? This is from the Buddha himself, Pali Canon. How does it work out? A lot of cancellation. There's a lot of cancellation. Do something really negative. Step on somebody's foot. Intentionally. Ah, not like you. Give them a black toe. And then feel remorse for it. But then, having feeling remorse for it, resolving not to do it in the future, then when you're out on the street, as I had the opportunity to do this morning, how those beetles get on their back, I've never figured out. Are they doing headstands? And then whoops, they fall over the back way? I've never figured out how that works. But I keep on seeing them periodically. What are you going to do? I mean, you're going to flip it over on its belly. At least, it, you know, if that's a die, it doesn't want to die this way. You know, let me die properly. Let the beetle die with a bit of nobility. Not like, So what do? So you flip it over, right? So you go out of your way. That's not quite foot stomping, but it's just the opposite. You could, I mean, obviously, you could do something harmful to it. Or you could just pass it by and say, not my business, not my family member. Or you can flip it over. You go out of your way to do things that are just the opposite of harming. And so in this way, this is crucially important, by engaging in virtue, especially virtue that's diametrically opposed to that which we've done that's unwholesome, that purifies it. There's no way we can experience the ripening of all of our karma. So that just neutralizes it. Gone. Okay, boop, boop. So you don't get a fortunate rebirth from flipping the beetle over on its tummy. But nevertheless, don't get a negative birth in foot stomping hell. Cancels itself out. Right? That's the 19th hell, by the way, there. 18 in the classic text and the one that I created. Just for foot stompers. And then, ending on a really good note, cultivation of four immeasurables. Tremendous. If you're purifying all kinds of negative karma. And then ending on this note, Shantideva, first chapter, where it's in praise of bodhicitta. He says, cultivate bodhicitta. This, I will say, because I believe it, the most sublime of all aspirations, to achieve perfect awakening in order to alleviate the suffering of all beings. What's really, what's higher than that? For as long as it takes, for as long as space remains and all of that. He said, cultivating this bodhicitta, if you want to know the impact on your negative karma, this is like the conflagration at the end of an eon when everything incinerates. Like if you're on a planet and your neighborhood sun goes supernova, it just incinerates everything. There's just nothing left because it's just not even ash. It's just gone, right? That's bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a supernova for negative karma. And you won't be able to remember all the karmas, you know, five lifetimes ago and 13 years ago and so forth. You don't remember all that stuff. Doesn't matter. You don't have to hit each one like hitting a dart, you know, dartboard with each individual dart. Cultivate some enormous virtue like bodhicitta. Incinerates. Just purifies. Tremendous purification. So it is said, and so rightly and so importantly, there is no virtue, there's no non-virtue that we can engage in that is so powerful, that is so negative, that it can't be purified. It doesn't matter what it is. Killing one's parents, mother or father. That's one of those super heavy ones. You just get to the bottom, you just go right from the bottom directly down into really intense hell if you don't purify it. Even that, some of the most horrendous that one can imagine, that can be purified. There's nothing that can't be purified. So this is good news. No one's hopeless. But then, of course, to develop the remorse, to purify it, then we get into gear and do it. Okay? So that's in-between session. Back to settling the mind in its natural state, let it be. Let it dissolve of its own accord. Good. Whew. Oh, lasso. I'm so happy not to have to talk for the rest of the day. I had an hour and a half conversation over lunch break with some two important conversations, but this is my final word. I'm talked out.